Welcome to the KMUD News. In this episode, we have stories on new business regulations in Fortuna and from our media partners. But first, some local alerts and updates. This is KMUD News. Starting off with a programming note. Thank you for bearing with us this week, as we've had reduced stories due to myself and our assistant director being sick. But we're making sure you still get your nightly newscast. We have a story from Daniel Mintz for you during this episode, and hope to be back to our usual KMUD News output next week. From the Eureka Police Department. The Eureka Police Department arrested 9 drivers suspected of driving under the influence during a nearly 3-week period through the Labor Day weekend. The enforcement efforts were part of a national Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over mobilization campaign, where officers were on patrol throughout the city to take suspected impaired drivers off the road. Among those arrested, 4 were cited for driving under the influence of drugs and 1 for a combination of alcohol and drugs. In addition to patrols, Eureka Police Department held a DUI checkpoint on September 1st, leading to 2 DUI arrests. Most Californians consider drunk driving as one of their biggest traffic safety concerns, with drunk driving crashes accounting for 34% of all traffic deaths in the state in 2024. This equates to about 4 people killed every day. First-time charges for DUI in California are an average of $13,500 in fines and penalties, which could include a suspended license. The Eureka Police Department reminds the public that impaired driving could be caused by more than just alcohol. The use of cannabis products, illicit drugs, even prescription and over-the-counter medications can lead to impairment. From the Klamath National Forest. Recent precipitation, cooler temperatures, and shorter days have decreased fire danger in the higher elevations of the Klamath National Forest, allowing fire restrictions in designated wilderness to be dropped. This means that campfires are permitted on Klamath National Forest lands in the Marble Mountain Wilderness, Trinity Alps Wilderness, Russian Wilderness, and the Siskiyou Wilderness, effective September 8th. A valid California campfire permit is required for campfires in wilderness. While campfires are now permitted, it's important to remember that we are still in fire season and fire restrictions are still in place for the rest of the Klamath National Forest. Next is an announcement from the Whale Gulch Volunteer Fire Company. The Whale Gulch Volunteer Fire Company will host its annual fundraiser on Saturday, September 19th at the meadow down Thompson Creek Road in Whale Gulch, starting at noon. Come join our coastal community for burgers, hot dogs, and a bake sale. There will be live music by local bands Retrofit and Wolf Tree. There will be flow arts and other kids' activities, along with a raffle and official Whale Gulch VFC merchandise. Come out to the beautiful Lost Coast and support the Whale Gulch Volunteer Fire Company. And up next, our main stories. This is KMUD News. Following recent state police enforcement of prostitution laws, Fortuna is taking action to regulate massage businesses. Daniel Mintz reports.
Spurred by concern that some massage businesses offer more than just massages, Fortuna is poised to approve a new ordinance regulating them. At the September 7th Fortuna City Council meeting, City Police Chief Matt Eberhardt said the nonprofit California Massage Therapy Council has worked with the California Police Chiefs Association for years to develop, quote, resources that aid in the implementation of local ordinances to address criminal activity associated with massage establishments, prostitution, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking. It's something Fortuna has had some experience with. Last June, state police took action against a massage studio in the city, and multiple misdemeanor prostitution-related charges were filed. Prosecution of the case is still underway, and Eberhardt said new regulations would strengthen the city's hand.
This ordinance was drafted in a manner that takes local massage establishments conducting legitimate business into consideration while providing us appropriate tools to address crime, protect public safety, and make it clear that our community does not support crimes that can be associated with massage establishments, such as prostitution, sexual exploitation, and human trafficking. I wish I was here tonight saying something different, but unfortunately, some of these crimes do exist in our community. Council is aware of a state agency addressed criminal activity case on one of our local massage establishments that is pending prosecution, and that the establishment is back in operation as we lack the local framework to address the situation. Furthermore, we've had past prostitution case with a different massage establishment in our community, and recently received a complaint regarding an establishment that I'm not at liberty to discuss publicly. Our department has been discussing the need for an ordinance of this nature for some time.
Eberhardt said the new ordinance will create a city registration program and standards of operation and sanitation. Administrative processes will include inspections and background checks for non-certified employees and owners. The ordinance also gives the police department, quote, clear authority to deny, suspend, or revoke registrations for qualifying criminal violations or refusal of permit inspections, Eberhardt continued. He described the goals of the ordinance.
This ordinance protects law-abiding businesses from unfair association with unlawful conduct while giving law enforcement the tools needed to keep our community safe. Additionally, it's been brought to my attention that a broader citywide ordinance covering all of Fortuna business licenses, allowing suspension or non-renewal across all business types, might be a comprehensive approach, as crimes can occur in other businesses as well. I agree that that would be a helpful tool, and I'm open to exploring the citywide business license ordinance with the city attorney in the future. And I feel that this massage establishment ordinance is a positive step in that direction.
Most council members supported the ordinance, but Councilmember Abe Stevens vouched for a broader approach.
And I think I would probably be a little more skeptical of this, just because I've got kind of an advocate for personal liberty, and kind of feel that what people do in the privacy of their home or their business is kind of their own, choice, but obviously, my personal opinions don't overrule state law, so I think if people are breaking the law, then obviously we need to enforce that. But I think I would just be a little hesitant to kind of add more burdens to, massage businesses in particular. I think I would probably be more in favor of, as you had said, maybe a broader ordinance that kind of regulates just illegal activity in general.
The first reading of the ordinance was approved, with Stevens voting against. Councilmember Kyle Conley was absent. Also at the meeting, the council fielded a presentation about how Vero Fiber is bringing high-speed internet to the city. The company is in an engineering phase on the project, which will soon be up for permitting approval. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Community leaders in Frederick, Maryland are demanding answers after a clash between protesters and Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents left several people injured last Friday night. Residents say agents had been in the Tasker's Chance neighborhood for days before tensions escalated when protesters tried to block officers from a home believed to be targeted by ICE. Videos of the incident on social media show ICE agents striking protesters who are surrounding them as local law enforcement attempt to separate the two groups shortly after the ICE agents charge inside the house.
Back up!
witness Tatiana Santos said, quote, "I saw the aftermath of that. People walking away from the scene visibly injured. People with scrapes on their foreheads. Somebody was concerned about their hand being broken." Local activist Sula Kemp said, quote, "They didn't hold back with how hard they were hitting people that were unarmed." No arrests were made, and it's unclear whether officers had a warrant. An ICE spokesperson said, quote, "Under President Trump and Secretary Mullen, if you break the law, you will face the consequences." Democratic Representative April McLean Delaney, who represents the district, called the situation deeply concerning, saying, quote, "I am especially disturbed by reports that ICE agents used force against Frederick residents. These allegations demand immediate answers and a full, transparent investigation." Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, for roughly 200,000 Salvadoran immigrants remains in place tonight as the Trump administration weighs the future of the program. The protections were scheduled to expire today, but the Department of Homeland Security said Salvadorans covered by TPS remain protected from deportation and are authorized to work in the United States until the administration announces a decision. The uncertainty comes as the Trump administration has moved to terminate TPS protections for immigrants from more than a dozen countries, affecting more than a million people. But El Salvador occupies an unusual position. Lauren Schmidt reports.
Unlike countries such as Afghanistan and Haiti, whose TPS designations have been terminated, the Trump administration has forged a close partnership with Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. As El Salvador accepted hundreds of people deported from the United States, including Venezuelans sent to SECOT, the country's massive maximum security prison, which has faced mounting allegations of torture and sexual violence. The partnership also extends to military operations, with U.S. aircraft operating from El Salvador in connection with Pacific boat strikes that human rights groups have characterized as extrajudicial executions. As previously reported by KPFA, in July, Nayib Bukele made an unannounced trip to Washington, D.C. for a closed-door meeting with President Trump. The visit came as uncertainty was growing over the future of TPS for Salvadorans. The visit received relatively little attention from major news outlets, something Tim Muth, a U.S. civil rights attorney and author of the weekly newsletter El Salvador Perspectives, took note of.
Nayib Bukele made a trip not previously announced to Washington, D.C. to meet with President Trump in a closed-door working session. The White House has acknowledged that that meeting took place. There has not been any readout on what the two discussed. That's really unusual for Nayib Bukele, who is all about publicity and having an entire media entourage follow him around and show him in the halls of power in places like D.C. Perhaps their very popular president went to advocate for them.
El Salvador's economy is heavily dependent on money sent home by Salvadorans living in the United States. Last year, Salvadorans sent home nearly $10 billion in remittances, which is equivalent to roughly 24% of the country's entire gross domestic product, forcing tens of thousands of longtime TPS holders to leave the United States could therefore have economic consequences in El Salvador. But TPS also presents a complicated political question for Bukele. Congress created the program for people already in the United States who cannot safely return to countries experiencing conditions like armed conflict or natural disasters. President Bukele, meanwhile, has promoted El Salvador's dramatic decline in homicides and its transformation from one of the world's most violent countries in the world to one of the safest. A stark contrast to conditions in countries such as Haiti, where the Trump administration has ended TPS despite continuing gang violence, mass displacement, and a humanitarian crisis. And that difference raises questions about why Salvadorans remain in limbo and whether the close relationship between Bukele and Trump could play a role in what happens next. As of news time, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services had posted an alert to its website, reading, quote, "An announcement on El Salvador's TPS will be made at the appropriate time. Until such announcement is made, Salvadoran individuals present in the U.S. under TPS retain protection, including work authorization," close quote. Under federal law, if Homeland Security takes no action, the protections are automatically extended for 6 months. But for families across the country, that leaves long-term questions unresolved. Doris Landaverde is a mother of three U.S. citizens. She says the uncertainty is stressful.
I'm from El Salvador, an TPS holder since 2001. The way they are pushing us, you know, with determination is like, for example, in my case, we are owner of the house. You know, if I lose the TPS, I can continue working in how to pay the house. So like how to continue also, I will lose healthcare. My kids will affect because they are under my healthcare. And yeah, this is the damage that this administration are doing in this moment, because they just not just harm my person as an individual, but they harm the U.S. citizens' children.
About 200,000 Salvadorans have lived in the United States under TPS since 2001, following devastating earthquakes that left hundreds of thousands of people homeless. Just before leaving office, President Joe Biden extended TPS for Salvadorans for 18 months, set to expire today, September 9th. Still, the uncertainty facing Salvadorans stands in stark contrast to what has already happened to hundreds of thousands of Haitians. The Trump administration terminated TPS for roughly 350,000 Haitians this summer. And the loss of protections come as Haiti is facing conditions that closely resemble the kinds of extraordinary and temporary circumstances the United States government itself identifies as grounds for TPS. Nearly 1.5 million people are currently displaced inside the country, while millions more require humanitarian assistance. Yet deportations from the United States continue. Among those recently deported is a professional boxer, Jay Dabalus, born in the Bahamas.
I just arrived in Haiti. I don't know much about Haiti. Actually, I don't know anything about Haiti. I wasn't born here. I was born in Bahamas. And I've been living in the USA for about 20-something years. Other than that, I'm in the land of Haiti. It is nice here, but I'm trying to move on. I don't have any resources, family members, or people that aid me. So I'm just trying to see how I can, you know, go from there.
Family vive New York.
I have my residency status. I left Haiti when I was 5, and my family lives in New York City. It is a racist place. I didn't commit the crime, but they arrested me anyway. I was the black person in the group. They sentenced me to 19 years in prison. Then ICE came and took me without questioning me. They sent me here.
Haitian communities inside the United States have also faced intense immigration enforcement. In Springfield, Ohio, federal immigration authorities placed electronic ankle monitors on some Haitian immigrants. Among them was Pierre Damas Bell, a 20-year-old student athlete at Wright State University, who, on August 31st, committed suicide. His family points to his stress and depression over his immigration status and ankle monitor. Carl Ruby, the family's pastor, later read a statement on behalf of the Bell family.
After my son was outfitted with the ankle monitor, he felt like he was treated like an animal. He took two trips to Cincinnati and Westerville to plead the officers to remove the bracelet since he's a soccer player, and he felt embarrassed and humiliated when he's among his classmates at the university. It's a student rights state. He was bullied a lot, with a lot of people telling him he's a criminal. Last Friday, August 28, 2026, he told me, "Dad, I felt humiliated since they gave uniforms to all of my classmates at GROTC. Their uniforms, everyone got uniforms except for me because of the bracelet. This morning, he left the house before 8 a.m. He called me at 8:03 on a video call. And he said, 'Dad, I'm not feeling okay. I'm not thinking right because of the bullies.' And I told him, come home so that we can talk. I had my youngest to take to school, so I took him to school. Around 11 o'clock, police showed up at my door to report that my son had thrown himself under a truck."
Amid uncertainty for TPS holders, immigrant rights advocates are organizing actions throughout California and the country this week.
My name is Danny Celaya with CSO Oakland, the Oakland chapter of the Community Service Organization. We want to continue to stand up for Salvadoranian community because of how so many folks rely on TPS, about nearly 200,000 folks. And this is not the only thing that immigrants are facing. So one of the reasons why CSO is, you know, planning this protest on Thursday is also to demand, just to also bring attention to the fact that Trump has also announced the biggest revocation of visas in U.S. history. He is planning to also cancel the visas of about 200,000 visa holders, specifically folks seeking asylum. This is a very busy time for the fight for immigrant rights.
In Oakland, the Community Service Organization and Legalization for All are holding a rally Thursday at 6 p.m., taking place at the northwest corner of 14th and Broadway. And in Los Angeles, Centro CSO is holding another action Saturday, September 12th at noon, taking place at 4th and Soto Streets.
And I also want to plug in our folks in our member organizations in Texas, at Austin and Dallas and El Paso, specifically over in Dallas, where the Republican National Convention, their midterm convention, is happening. So our folks over there also, you know, standing up and saying, you know, hell no to Trump's and the Republicans' anti-immigrant agenda.
Advocates are calling for a permanent path to legal status and using this period of uncertainty to organize and mobilize their communities. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
California's power bills are the second highest in the nation and almost double the national average, according to a new report from the nonprofit Energy Innovation and Grid Lab. The report cites higher costs for distribution and transmission, in part because of wildfire prevention work and massive liability from blazes like those that destroyed Paradise and Altadena, caused by sparks from utility poles. Mike O'Boyle with Energy Innovation says the utilities have passed on those costs to electric customers.
Wildfire mitigation has essentially been paid out of people's electricity bills, and what we need is to redistribute that risk for three main groups: utilities, taxpayers, and communities that can harden themselves against wildfire risk.
The report concedes that some of the cost pressures are out of California's control, including inflation and tariffs that drive up the costs of materials to expand the grid. But the authors do say the state should simplify regulations and create standard reporting requirements to make it easier for the California Public Utilities Commission to oversee utility costs. O'Boyle also supports programs and time-varying electricity rates to increase the efficiency of the grid by encouraging customers to use big appliances in the middle of the day rather than at peak times in the evening.
We have to create rates that give people the incentive to actually adjust their behavior to use the grid more efficiently, and that will drive down costs for everybody.
The report also calls for expanded customer participation in programs that pay people with electric vehicles or heat pumps to adjust their usage, for example, reducing demand when temperatures rise or charging when solar is abundant. In addition, California policymakers and the insurance industry are discussing proposals to require homeowners to create defensible space around their homes in return for lower premiums. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
That's all for our news broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our rotation of broadcast engineers, Dennis Marr, Katie Phillips, Brianna Federico, Michael McCaskill, Larry Lashley, and Javier Rodriguez. Also thanks to our reporter for this broadcast, Daniel Mintz. KMUD News is now on streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening. You can also follow us on social media at KMUD News, including Facebook and Instagram. Do you have issues important to you that deserve more attention? Are there stories we're missing or that you're curious about? You can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio Incorporated is funded by Press Forward, a national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingtao, Milwaukee, Wia, Wilka, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, acknowledging the ongoing cultural, spiritual, physical connection that these tribes have to the region. I'm April Lewis. Stay tuned in.